The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, and Chicago. And if you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, Tim. What's up?
Oh, a lot of everything. It's another beautiful day here in Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes, it is. And evidently, we are now the home of the 2016 Republican National Convention. Tour de France this week?
It's been fabulous so far. I can't remember a more exciting one.
Well, it feels more like Paris-Roubaix.
Yes.
At least the first few stages, huh? Cold, wet, cobblestones. Took its toll of riders early, huh?
Yep.
No more Chris Froome.
Nope.
No, he abandoned in stage five. He fell in stage four. He fell twice in stage five. And I guess three strikes and you're out, huh?
I think that was enough. Yeah. I think he probably shouldn't have started even stage five. But
it's been one of the best races in a long time.
I think it has. And we've got some Americans now that...
What did I say last week?
I know.
Uh-huh. Talansky just listened to The Outspoken Cyclist. Anyway... I am not enjoying, I have to say, the NBCSN coverage of the race. I am so annoyed with the commercial interruptions. It's like you get 2 minutes of racing, 5 minutes of commercials, a minute and a half of racing, 8 minutes of commercials. It's making me crazy. So I usually end up watching the wrap-up at the end of the day. You know, they do a short wrap-up.
Yes, yeah. Right.
And then, you know, you can always follow the race, like, in real time with the live update guy, Charles Pelkey.
You can follow that. The other thing that I usually do is cyclingfans.com. They've got five or six different links that are live links, and they're out of Europe. So I end up usually watching the Eurosport version of it if you're watching it live.
Well, that makes sense. So I want to offer a little bit of counterbalance to the tour. I feel like the tour sort of takes over the media during this time of year for cyclists. But I'd like to mention Marianne Vos.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. She is the current overall leader of the Women's Tour of Italy, the Giro, you know, Rossa. She is also a multiple world champion. She's widely considered, ready for this, to be the best all-around bike racer since Eddie Merckx.
Wow.
So she just came out to support a new initiative for the final week of the tour called the UCI Women's Cycling Week. There's going to be a whole bunch of events, everything for women who are just casual to, and some are riding from England to Paris. They're doing all kinds of cool stuff. And on the last day, of course, of the tour is La Course, the women's race on the Champs-Élysées. You know, we were hoping for more than one day, but hey, one day is better than no days.
It's a start.
So very good. This week, we're going to give even more substance to the women's side of bike racing. We have not spoken with Sarai Snyder in a long time. She is the founder of Girl Bike Love and the co-founder of Cyclofem. And Cyclofem, which was Mother's Day, as it always is, had a gazillion races. I should say rides. It's strictly rides this year. She's going to speak with us about a new initiative. It's called Women Race Bikes. It's a new project that was just launched. Sarai says, we tell the courageous stories of women on two wheels, inspiring fans, empowering riders, encouraging equal opportunity to honor and grow the sport of cycling. So she will be with us in a little bit. We'll also chat with another really cool lady. Her name is Steph Routh. She calls herself, and anyone who gets on a bike, ready for this, a funnest.
I love that.
If you get on a bike and you have fun, you're a funnest. So I think it's a cool term. Her new book is called How to Move by Bike.
Okay.
Okay. It's published by our friend Ellie Blue at her Taking the Lane Publishing. Yeah. It's step-by-step instructions on how to get a bunch of other people along with you to load your up your stuff and pedal to your new abode.
That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. Steph will also tell us about some of the other projects in which she's been involved, and she's won a bunch of awards. She's really an interesting woman. And then my first guest is our, and I'm really excited about this, is our 2014 U.S. National Pro Road Champion, Dr. Eric Marcotte. Now, I remember we spoke with Dan Worry a couple of weeks ago, and Dan told us about Eric and what kind of a champion he is. He is a full-time chiropractor, as well as the member of the Smart Stop Pro Cycling Team. And Eric's views about how he's able to continue to train, ride, and win races, as well as run his own chiropractic clinic, might give you a new food for thought on your own riding regimen. He has some really interesting ideas. So we're going to head on down to Scottsdale, Arizona, where I caught up with the healthy Dr. Marcotte just after finishing up his morning training ride. And he's heading into his doctor's office for an adjustment. Let's hear why. Eric, thanks for joining me on the show today, and congratulations.
Well, thanks for having me, Dan.
You know, I talked to Dan Worry a couple weeks ago about Nationals, and it became pretty clear that you are not the average professional cyclist.
Well, physically, probably, right? We're all pretty close physically, but like what happens off of the bike might be a little bit different.
I think so. Tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, how you got into cycling, and when you began racing.
Where I grew up was Upper Michigan, the Upper Peninsula, pretty rural, Marquette, right on Lake Superior, like an outdoor kid, and went to undergrad up there. And then I went to chiropractic school in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And background-wise, I was always in sports, my brother and I, and I always stayed pretty fit and athletic. And then through chiropractic school or undergrad to chiropractic school, I was just spending a lot of time in the gym doing the muscle thing because I thought that was important. And then when I got into chiropractic school, it just kind of opened my eyes up to a little deeper level of health and wellness, not just being physically looking good, but like on the inside too. And so started to do endurance sports like running and swimming in the winter there in Minneapolis because it was cold. And then in the spring, I got on a bike and just started racing and obviously took off and really did well. And that's basically how I got into it. And then somehow I was able to couple staying in school and racing locally there and then more regionally. And then when I moved out here to Arizona, I dialed back. I barely raced at all in 2008. And then in 2009, I'm a competitive person and I wanted to get that out of my system. We started racing well out here in the Southwest and then people started to take note. And again, was able to somehow balance the running somebody else's practice initially with racing. I wouldn't be able to do the races that I'm doing now. And then about 3 years ago, I opened up my own clinic. And that's when you could set your own hours and whatnot, you can basically do what you want.
So you carry a full patient load?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, like, these last 3 weeks since I've not raced, what did we do? We did North Star Grand Prix. It was Nature Valley Grand Prix before. Those are 5 days a week. But, like, let's say I'm in between a couple races and there's only 3 days in between, then I try to get the 5 days of patience into three. Yeah, I mean, it's not, like, 9 to 5 every day. I mean, there's no possible way. But it's a physical job, which is why I still have a little bit of muscle in my upper body, moving everybody around.
Do you have other doctors in your practice?
No, not yet. I mean, I think if I really had a little bit more time to sit back and look at how that dynamic would work. I mean, I really love the feeling and the vibe that I have at the clinic with me. There's some physical therapists that I delegate, some of the care to, and massage therapists. And, we've got a good system set up there. The thing is, and what's great about those providers is that they're doing a lot of sports and endurance athletes too. So it's one thing to be a good adjuster or understand chiropractic, but if you're not out there running a marathon or doing these bike races or swimming or whatever these endurance athletes are that I typically tend to see, more active lifestyle people, it's hard to really relate. And so that's where I think when I look at what I want to be doing with the clinic and the practice of, you know, providing this care for people, I don't want just somebody that can adjust good and is not going to connect with what it feels like to get done with a five-hour ride and understand what's going on with the body at that point.
What an interesting concept. And I think that that probably adds a very interesting dimension to your patients. I'm duly impressed, Eric. Duly impressed.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, when I look at what I want to do, I would say, well, what would I want my providers or people keeping an eye on me?
Sure.
What would I want them to already know or be able to help me out with? I mean, that's why we have this little group, this little system set up for people, because, like, if it's an active lifestyle person, like, just like me, I'm just finished training 3.5 hours. It's 9 o'clock, up at 4 in the morning, whatever. Now I'm going straight over and I'm driving on my way to get adjusted myself. My body, you know, endured some good pushes today, kind of open up the legs. My aerobic engine is far greater, because you can't be at the top level and not be imbalanced at some point. So as my engine is bigger than the chassis, so to speak, and it fails underneath. And so what I do is, as the body's healing, is I make sure that it heals as balanced as possible. And I don't think people quite understand that concept, because maybe there's this conflict of interest by saying, hey, you know what, Dan, if you're going to be training all the time, I'd like to see you every couple weeks or months to kind of keep an eye, make sure you don't get out of sort, where we have this, we're growing up in this, wait until you're broke down at the side of the road before you go see a physical therapist, a chiropractor, a massage therapist. And at that point, that tissue's damaged, it's injured, it really can't do a lot of work, whereas I'm taking the approach of, hey, while you're healthy and your body can actually respond and adapt to things, let's give it what it needs to come out of this okay, so that we don't go through the same thing that everybody else is here.
Wow, what a great concept. I am impressed. I'm speaking with Dr. Eric Marcotte. He is our national U.S. Pro Road Champion, which brings me to another question, and that is, you are 34 now, is that correct?
Yeah.
So do you think that this approach you're taking between your training and then what you do to rebuild, including adjustments and therapy, massage therapy, and that kind, do you think that will prolong your ability to ride at these kinds of levels?
I hope so, and I hope that's what people are, maybe the takeaway message from this is. I don't like to ram it down people's throats about prevention and wellness. I like to just be the role model or just do it, and then when people are ready, they kind of look further into it and say, well, what is really going on there, you know? I hope so, because, again, what I see every day with the clinic and the patients and the people that have come in who are either thriving or barely surviving, you look at what they're doing differently for the people that are doing great versus the ones that are, you know, in a crisis mode, like 2 weeks out, 4 weeks out from an Ironman, and they haven't done any prevention, and they're saying to you, hey, help me out of this hole. Like, man, look at this guy that was in here 6 months ago that's been doing prevention, that's full gas going into their A race.
Right.
Like, that's what... So yes, long story short, to answer that question, do I think I can last longer? Of course, because I'm keeping my body more closely balanced and keeping everything up to the level that the engine I'm building. Whereas I think you may top out on some people, because they're not focused on making sure everything else can actually handle what they're doing, the wattage that they've come up to, or, I mean, you name it, across the board, whether you're a basketball player, a golfer, a cyclist, runner, whatever. When you're doing one specific thing, you're training your body for that. There's a lot of imbalances with that. You may look in the mirror and you may look good as far as aesthetically, but it doesn't mean that you're going to be sustainable with that particular approach.
I hate to change the subject because I'm fascinated by your approach to it, and I really like it. But I'm going to talk about your win. You are our national champion. Congratulations again. That is so cool.
Yeah, it was pretty
pretty crazy. I mean, it's been a little bit now since it set in, and yeah, it was just obviously, like I said, I take a good approach. I had about a month between races there, and what's great about being able to be home is I can be doing all the things that we just talked about to allow my body to heal and really be going good.
Right.
Coming into a race, so I knew I had some good fitness. I was worried the morning, like, I just want to affect the race. I want to, you know, at least do something to let our team get a good result. You know, my teammate Travis has been doing just phenomenal, and we were really racing for him. And all in all, it just, everything just played out, like, so good for our team and myself. So it just, it was a good tactical day.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about your team, because it is a pro cycling team called Smart Stop. How many members are there? And I want to know a little bit about Creed. He's the manager, right?
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
I want to know a little bit about him, because he seems to be handling your team rather well.
Yeah, he's done really well at picking the group. I think we got 14 riders, and, you know, certainly not everybody can ride every race because there's limits on races, sometimes 6, sometimes 8. And so we pick the riders that have the best attributes for those particular races, or who maybe are the fittest at that point to go out and race. And as far as Creed is concerned, I mean, he just finished racing last year. So he raced with a lot of us and kind of understands what some of our potentials may be. And when you're in a better team and a little bit more support and a group of riders that rally around each other, it really brings it up to the next level when you see the successes your buddies are having, and then you want to come to that same level as well, you know?
How did this team come together? Tell me what Smart Stop is. Who is Smart Stop? Who are these sponsors?
Okay, Smart Stop is, they are a self-storage unit, and they have things all over. All over. I mean, it's like a $1 billion business. So the owner and the CEO, they really, his right-hand man is a big cycling guy, and he wanted to have a team, and has done a great job at supporting us, and hopefully we're doing a good job at, you know, getting that name out for him. I think that's really what's amazing about this, is that you get those, in cycling, you get these sponsors that are really willing to risk and put into something like this, and you know how many people are behind this team that are just having a successful year, and it's just a great thing to be able to be supported like that by somebody that's making quite a bit of money, right? And it changes all of our lives because of that. It's really pretty cool.
Belkin, who just came on as a sponsor, has announced that they're going to leave sponsorship, and here they have somebody who just won a stage of the tour, and now they're going away. Do you think SmartStop is the kind of sponsor that might actually move the team forward and bring it out to an international level? Are they interested in that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, actually, cool. There was just a press release where our team is like entertaining that offer to look to go to Division 2 and maybe even move the team to Canada, because there's really no professional team there that's at that level. And basically what's saying is, like, you know, there's so many people, and it's not like we're looking for donations individually for people-wise, like $5 here or something like that, but those people that are willing to have those big time relationships and be a part of something that's really, really neat that we're trying to do here. So yes, long story short, yeah, they're totally ready and willing to do it. I mean, they just want to have that extra support to be able to make it to that level, because it is a much bigger jump financially to do so.
Well, that was sort of where I was going with that. You know, it's one thing to sponsor a 14-member team here in the States and be a company in the States, but to then start internationally supporting a team, it's got to be exponentially a lot more financially and manpower wise too.
Yeah, exactly. So you, like, there's minimums of like what you have to come up with for the UCI or the ASO or whatever it is. Yep, minimum, just like there is minimums to be D3 and stuff like that. And I don't know what the staff-wise minimum is, but obviously the higher that we get, the more
people and level of rider that you're going to be needing to be able to actually be competitive and not, you know, be a joke out there.
Well, obviously, Smart Stop is not a joke. It's winning races. Do you race other disciplines besides road?
No, not really. I mean, sometimes in the, I'm trying to think of when I usually do this. Sometimes in the winter, like late, I may do, like, sometimes they have these endurance mountain bike races here, and they're like 10 hours, 12 hours. I mean, I'm just getting base miles anyway. You know, it's a lot of the local community. It's fun to go out there. You're just doing these hour loops. Everybody's having a good time, and yeah, just get a couple laps in, and then maybe even call it quits before it's even over. But yeah, sometimes I'll do something like that.
This has been just a fascinating, fascinating conversation, and I really like your approach. I wish you a lot of luck. I wish Team Smart Stop a lot of luck. I think we'll be watching that team for a long time. And go get your adjustment, get your food, and we'll talk again sometime. How's that?
That sounds great, Diane. Thanks for the call.
All right. Take care.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Eric Marcotte, our U.S. National Pro Road Champion for 2014, joined me from his car on his way to his doctor's appointment after his morning training ride. I don't know about getting up at 4 a.m. to train.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You know, I found what he had to say very, very interesting.
He's just a very interesting guy. And before we did the interview, I went again and watched the finish of the race, and it was amazing. He wasn't one that was supposed to win, but
no, I think it was they were hoping that one of his teammates might win, but very interesting. I also like the fact that his team is looking to expand and maybe go up into Canada and get bigger. So yep, we'll see what happens. We have time for some news before our break. You want to do some news?
Sure.
What you
we
got?
Can do that.
Got anything cool?
Yeah, something cool actually, and it's called Revo Lights. This is a complete different design of lighting front and rear on a bike. If you go to their website, revolights.com, Revo Lights,
okay,
you'll see that you actually take LED lights and secure them to your spokes. As the wheel rotates, there is a steady beam that goes out from the tire in front of you that lights your roadway. And then behind you, it's a steady beam of red light so people can see from the back. It's not up above the seat post or anywhere else. It actually illuminates the road. It's really one of the coolest things I've seen lately.
That sounds like one of the coolest things. What you got next?
Businessinsider.com. They've got a great article, and this is actually from July 3rd, but it's Meet the Nine Americans Competing in the Tour de France and the two who could potentially win the race. And there's a little short blurb on all of them. So we've got Chris Horner, Ted King, Ben King.
Wait a minute. Any relation? Probably not.
No.
Okay.
Peter Stettina, Danny Pate, Matthew Boucher, Alex Howes, TJ Vandegarden.
Yes.
And your guy.
My guy.
Andrew Talansky.
See, and he's currently in the top 10, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Go back and look at Stettina. You know, I mean, the Stettina family is basically almost a dynasty of cycling here in the United States.
His birthplace is Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah, that's the same people. Yeah. Very cool.
And really, the neat thing is he's on the same team with TJ Vandegarden.
Yeah.
It's a really nice article, and it's got a lot of quick bits in there that we don't always get to see. Sometimes with the team aspect of this race, a lot of times we lose where the Americans are at in that.
That's very, very true. This is an interesting pair of articles. Both of them appeared in the Washington Post. And the first one is titled, Bicyclist Bullies Try to Rule the Road in D.C. You know, what's really becoming interesting about all these articles as they get printed, posted, and then people start to make comments. And sometimes the comments are better than the article. So this is by a gentleman by the name of Cortland Milloy. He starts out by saying, I have to hand it to the bicyclists in the D.C. area. They've got more nerve than an L.A. biker gang, and some can be just as nasty. They fight to have bike lanes routed throughout the city, some in front of churches where elderly parishioners used to park their cars. They slow pedal those three-wheel rickshaws through downtown during rush hour, laughing at motorists who want them to get out of the way. Now, some of them are pushing to have a bicycle escalator installed on 15th Street Northwest, Going uphill from V Street to what used to be known as Malcolm X Park, DC will soon extend the 15th Street cycle track north, but riders will have to puff up a very steep hill, David Alpert, founder of Greater Washington, posted on his website July 3rd. Could that become easier with a piece of technology from Trondheim, Norway? With a bike escalator called a tramp, T-R-A-M-P-E, a cyclist just places a foot on the platform and lets it push him or her up the hill. Sounds like those escalators they have, like you put your card on in Target and they go up to the second story. So it goes on, and he's obviously not too happy with all the stuff that's happening to non-bicyclists, you know, in D.C. Well, the article got answered, and it got answered really fast. It got answered by a guy by the name of Ashley Halsey III. And one of the things I want to say about Mr. Halsey is that the only other picture I have seen of him besides the headshot that they use for the Washington Post is of him in a hospital bed with a broken neck. So we'll start with that.
Okay.
The name of the article is It's Time to Tone Down the Tirades Against Bicyclists. It's also in the Washington Post. It was published right after Mr. Malloy's article. So the very first thing the driver said was that he was sorry. This is Ashley Halsey talking. He had been looking for an address on a two-lane road, and when he saw it, he turned left toward it. I was coming the other way on my bike. He said he wasn't paying attention to the road. My neck was broken, my shoulder torn to pieces, and my hand had a spiral fracture. 6 years later, my neck doesn't turn like yours does. My handwriting has been transformed to that of an 80-year-old, and stuff like this happens to bike riders all the time. Not everyone is as lucky as me. A lot of cyclists get killed, more than 700 of them a year, including some people I've known. Am I biased? Sure. I ride thousands of miles every year. I also drive a car tens of thousands of miles. I will fly more than 50,000 miles this year, and I cover transportation for the Post. You could say I'm biased about every form of transportation, and you'd be right. But here's my bias. No matter how you go, bike, car, bus, train, boat, or plane, I want you to get there safely. I am sick to death of people who take risks with other people's lives. And lately, I've become disgusted with all the venom aimed at cyclists. It's a nice article. It goes on to sort of counter what this Mr. Malloy had to say. Then the comments just fly. So Washington Post, two articles, both this week.
And I think it's always interesting that some people just go to complete extreme that you never could have possibly imagined that they would get there.
Exactly. Exactly.
Remember last week we talked about the Penny in Your Pants video?
The Penny in Your Pants, but that was my video of the week.
Okay, that was
mistaken.
A cool video. And so I went back to watch it again just to see everything that was there. And then again, I found in the comments, there really is nothing new. Someone found in a Modern Women magazine, it had been posted earlier. And by earlier, I mean July of 1921. They actually posted that.
1921.
So
did they steal this idea, the modern people?
I don't think so. I don't think there was a video of it in 1921.
Oh, probably
so
not.
They
right.
probably didn't.
Okay.
But that then led me to the next article, which I found on Vox, VOX.com, the 19th century health scare that told women to worry about bicycle face.
What's the idea of bicycle face?
The idea is, and this is from a noted literary digest in 1895, the unconscious effort to maintain one's balance tends to produce a wearied and exhausted bicycle face. So doctors were actually telling women, you shouldn't ride because you may end up with bicycle face. Well, they weren't really so much worried about the bicycle face. As we know, in the 1890s in Europe and the U.S., bicycles were seen as an instrument of feminism.
Right.
So it was a great way to, you know, try to keep that down. But here's my favorite part. In 1897, a Chicago doctor, Sarah Hackett Stevenson, put the issue to rest by saying, the painfully anxious facial expression is seen only among beginners, and it's due to the uncertainty of amateurs. As soon as a rider becomes proficient, can gauge her muscular strength, and acquires perfect confidence in her ability to balance herself and in her power of locomotion, this look passes away.
So there.
So there. So that's my really interesting story of the week.
Well, this one comes from the Los Angeles Times, from LA Now. OC, meaning Orange County, cyclist hit by Gatorade bottle in road rage case may get charged.
Good.
No. The cyclist was hit by the bottle, but the cyclist is going to get charged.
The cyclist is getting charged.
I knew I would catch you on that one. Yeah. It turns out an Orange County cyclist who used his cell phone to document getting struck by a Gatorade bottle after a dispute with the passenger in a passing truck could also face charges in the incident, officials said. Orange County Sheriff's investigators have reviewed Brian Larson's video and recommended charges be filed against him and the truck passenger, the department spokesman, Lieutenant Jeff Halleck, said. The passenger may face assault and battery charges, while Larson could be looking at being charged with, quote, words in public likely to elicit a violent reaction, end quote, Halleck said. He declined to identify the passenger because she has not been arrested or charged. Mm-hmm. But they're willing to identify Mr. Larson.
Of course.
Of course. The video shows Larson riding his bicycle May 31st on Pacific Coast Highway in Dana Point when he is suddenly struck by a bottle of Gatorade thrown from the passenger side of a truck. He later claims the passenger also threw water bottles at him. Larson yells a profanity toward the truck, saying, "That's you on video. See you later," as the truck drives by him. The female passenger points at Larson and appears to exchange words with him before the truck speeds away. Larson later posted the video, urging the Sheriff's Department and the California Highway Patrol to, quote, "do something about what happened today. That is not okay," according to his Twitter account. Soon enough, the video has received roughly 16,500 views on YouTube. "I was definitely quite scared," Larson said on his YouTube page. He later told KCAL9 that he was riding with a friend when the truck tried to run him off the road, so he pulled out his cell phone and filmed the exchange. The video apparently bothered some cycling safety advocacy groups who Halleck said believed the Sheriff's Department was not investigating the incident. Sheriff's Department presented their case to the Orange County District Attorney, but it was rejected June 20th, Halleck said. They continued investigating the case, however, and are now recommending the latest set of proposed charges.
The great thing, though, and we've talked about this before with GoPro cameras and YouTube and everything that's up there.
It's hard to get away with it.
It's hard for them to do that. So,
that's true.
One last story here. While I was Wednesday night, I was flipping around trying to get my updates on the tour, and I found the Global Relay Gastown Grand Prix, and it was actually streamed live. There was a women's race, which was 35 laps or 42 kilometers, and a men's race, which was 50 laps and 60 kilometers, and it was really great to be able to actually see it live. And the nice thing also was the winner of the women's event got $13,000.
Yay! Real money. Yep. That's real money.
Yes, it is. So, nice job, Global Relay Gastown Grand Prix.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we're going to go take a break, and we'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
And we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. So let's head on out to Portland, Oregon, and talk to just one of the funnest people ever. The funnest.
Yes.
Okay. Steph Routh, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Thank you very much for having me, Diane. Pleasure.
What does it feel like to be the, quote, mayor of Hopscotch Town?
I've known a couple of other mayors who actually have constituencies, and having a mayor without a constituency feels pretty good.
What is Hopscotch Town?
Hopscotch Town is it's a small publishing and consulting firm that inspires and celebrates fun, lovable places for everyone.
Wow, that sounds like fun. Everybody likes fun.
Yeah, and the first, so I had started it last October, shortly after I had ended my tenure at Oregon Walks, which is Oregon's statewide walking advocacy nonprofit organization, and wanted to focus on the fun side of what we had been doing in terms of transportation advocacy.
How did you go from whatever you were doing before, and what were you doing before you got into advocacy, walking, biking, all of it?
Oh, that's a good question. I had been an opera theater double major, which some people would say that I double majored in unemployment. but just through a series of events, I had been working in New York City and teaching acting and script writing at an alternative school in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, and just came to understand that access to opportunity is of critical importance, and I wanted to work more on that. So when I came back to Portland, I had been working a little bit on transit justice in Brooklyn. When I came back to Portland, I started working first in international development with sustainable water systems and renewable energy for a really great organization called Green Empowerment. And then and had been doing bike advocacy on the side. And then when the position for Oregon Walks came up, I was like, wait, I could do this full time. This would be great.
They'll actually pay me to do this.
Yeah,
exactly.
Depending on your definition of pay. Yeah.
That's true. We're never paid what we're worth. Let's tell the truth here. I want to talk about something about fun, and that is, what is Umbrella and what is Cycle Wild?
I should back up before Umbrella. There's a really there's a loose association of bike funnists in town. In
okay,
Portland.
Wait. You have to. That was my next question. You have to define bike funnist.
Well, if you're having fun and you're on a bike, you are a bike funnist.
Okay, got it.
And so Shift is a really great group of, again, also all volunteers who get together and do things like Breakfast on the Bridges, which is a monthly event where people, volunteers, brew coffee and get pastries and just give them out as a thank you to people for biking as well as walking on, I believe now, three of Portland's bridges across the Willamette River. And another, there's something called Pedalpalooza, which is 3+ weeks of bike fun. And that's always in June, about 3 weeks in June. And it's an open calendar. Anyone can post a ride. Anyone can lead a ride. And this past year, I think we had almost 300 bike events on the calendar.
Wow, in 3 weeks?
Yeah. So you physically can't go to them all, even if you don't sleep for 3 weeks, which is pretty exciting. But you know, all of that requires, you know, there's a reason people get nonprofit status, because you need a place to hold your accounts and to get donations and to be able to process those donations and to ensure that the people who are helping, you know, buy the AirPod or, you know, buying the web hosting for the open calendar, that they know where that their money is going into a good place. And so Shift had been what's called fiscally sponsored by another organization, but because Shift had grown, we talked about, you know, creating our own organization. And the idea of a loose association of bike funnists fulfilling a 990 every year to the IRS was hilarious, and we decided that not to do that. So
what do you do?
So instead, we created a separate fiscal sponsorship organization that would fiscally sponsor groups and great ideas like Shift. And so that was called Umbrella, because we wanted it to be an umbrella organization, and it rains in Oregon, so there was a lot of hilarity in making the name.
Sure. That makes sense. I'm speaking with Steph Routh. She is a funnist, a bicycle funnist out in Portland, Oregon, and she's written a very interesting book, which we're going to get to in a moment. So I wanted to ask a little something about Breakfast on the Bridges. We have some really interesting bridges here across the Cuyahoga River. And I'm wondering, do you offer on your on some site how you go about doing some of these things? Have other areas picked up some of your ideas? I have heard of Pedopalooza.
Oh, great. Well, and you know what? I do think that Cleveland has had at least one iteration of Breakfast on the Bridges, because one of the parents of one dedicated shift volunteer, Lily Karabaic, they ended up doing a B&B at least once.
Huh. That's interesting. I know a lot of stuff's going on that I may not be aware of because my tentacles are often out of the city instead of in the city. But you actually have in your midst somebody who was very instrumental in getting something called Walk and Roll here in Cleveland. That's Lois Moss.
Yeah.
You probably
She's
have met her.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate her. Your loss has been our gain, in my apologies.
So I've heard. All right, so we're going to talk about your new project. I think this is going to be very important. I actually have a friend who did this in Colorado many, many years ago, so to see that there's a book written about it is quite interesting. Along with our friend Ellie Blue, who I think Taking the Lane is her company and helped publish this, you have written a book called How to Move by Bike. Yes?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Did you actually move by bike before you wrote this book?
Yes, I've moved twice, and I've helped other people move a little over 70 times so far.
It's How
actually
many?
Kind of a 70 or so.
Holy smokes, people are actually doing this.
Yes, it's actually, it's kind of a big deal. I think that there have been two bike moves this month. We are getting to a point where, you know, you'll have sometimes more than one bike move on a weekend day. And luckily there's enough people who love helping moving by bike so much that, you know, you have enough of a crew to get both people moved.
So how do you do that?
So, this is a good question. Well, in so many ways, it's actually just like a traditional move, except it doesn't have, it obviously doesn't have a car. Instead of, you know, renting a U-Haul that, you know, this huge behemoth that, you know, I don't know if driving a U-Haul scares me.
Well, it's pretty scary. They're big boxy trucks. I know.
And you're not used to them and you don't know how they handle and, you know, they have blind spots and, you know, you're often going in an urban setting and it can be really scary. So, and what I learned in just from census data is that, you know, six out of 10, you have tons of people who are moving every year. And 6 out of 10 of the people who move actually move within their own county. These aren't long distance moves. It's possible to, you know, to have something that is a bike, you know, on a shorter commute. And also it's actually quicker for the most part. Instead of getting, you know, this bottleneck of, you know, two people maximum who can load something into a U-Haul at the same time, you have, you know, anywhere from 10 to 75 people with varying capacities. Some people have cargo bikes, some people have, you know, bikes at work trailers, some people have panniers or backpacks or a front rack or a basket, and you just load what you can. And strangely, it all works out. So you invite people, you make them coffee, you don't make them pack. That's an important part.
Yeah, that sounds like an important part. Yeah. Okay.
Like we're here to help you move your stuff, not to pack your stuff. And, you know, people kibitz for about half an hour, you know, just drinking coffee. And then the load up, I've never seen it take more than 45 minutes for a load up. Then you ride. I think that the longest distance that anyone's done a ride here has been, I want to say 20 miles.
That's still pretty far. Hauling stuff around.
Yeah, it's a clip. And then, you know, you spend, I don't know, half an hour, if that, unloading, because you have so many people helping. And then what was your move becomes your housewarming party.
Pretty cool.
It's efficient and super fun. We had my boyfriend and I moved early last year. We had 70 people show up, and it was 10 miles. You know, I'd say a good third of the people didn't even have anything to carry. They were just along for the parade. And that's the other great part of it. It looks like a parade. And people are just so, they just find it so funny on the whole to like see a plant coming out of someone's basket or, you know, a couch on someone's trailer.
Which brings me to my next question. What is the largest and heaviest item that you've ever moved?
Gun safe.
Oh my goodness. How did that, those are big and heavy. How did that get moved?
Well, the big thing was that that included going down a multi-use path and that had bollards. So they had to jack up the gun safe on some other really light but sturdy sturdy furniture underneath on top of the trailer so that the gun safe, the wide gun safe, could clear the bollards.
Who could pedal such a thing?
You know, someone with gears and chutzpah.
There are a few of those people around. Oh, that is hilarious. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. So what other projects are you getting into? And we're going to tell people how to get a copy of How to Move by Bike. Go ahead. What else are you going
to
do?
Well, I'll just say How to Move by Bike is on Amazon. And also you can go to hopscotchtown.com and you can find it there. Other projects, you know, there's a couple of podcasts, you know, like yours.
Well, you know, we didn't talk about that, but you did co-host the KBOO bike show out of Portland for a while. And that show's been on the air a long time.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a great time with that for about 3 years. One of our favorite, we had Randy Cohen, the ethicist, talk about the ethics of cycling, which was a lot of fun. And after about 3 years, I was like, you know what? I think I'd like to talk about a little more than cycling. So I'm currently talking with a couple of folks to do another podcast. And we have a shared podcasting space now with Bike Portland. They have a podcast and also another really great podcast. It's an hour long weekly called the Sprocket Podcast. And they talk about, you know, low-car living and enjoying the best that life has to offer. That's Brock Dittus and Aaron Brones. And, I'm looking to do a podcast on justice in the built environment.
Wow, you are just one busy lady. No kidding. Well, once again, Stephanie Routh, Steph, we call her. She has written a book called How to Move by Bike. She's done a lot of things. Thank you so much for talking to me today. This has been a lot of fun. I knew it would be. You're a character, and I'm a character, and everybody loves characters.
Diane, this is the highlight of the week. Thank you so much.
Have a great rest of your weekend. All right.
Well, when you come to Portland, join us.
What a nice invitation. I appreciate that. You have a great evening.
You too, my love.
Thanks, Steph. Steph Routh joined me from her parents' home in Oregon. Want to go move by bike?
No.
Me neither. I don't want to move again.
I'm okay with two men in a truck.
Yeah. I told Brian the next time I moved anywhere, he would have to sedate me. Well, we're going to head on out to Salt Lake City, Utah. This is not usually where Sarai Snyder is, but she is. She's there for the weekend. We're going to talk about a new initiative that just got launched. Sarai, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Awesome.
Let's talk a little bit about Girl Bike Love. What's going on? What's new with that? I mean, we have a big announcement to make, but let's just catch up a little bit.
Girl Bike Love is growing. It's steadily kind of always there. Drawing in new people and sharing new stories and just kind of gathering that community. So I think that's the awesome part about it, is just that it's stable and growing and everybody's happy and I love it.
I know you do, and that shows in how well it's doing. So one of the things I find really interesting is how much cycling is going on in parts of the world for women who you think might not be on bikes, Afghanistan, for example, Rwanda. How is your organization involved with women cycling on sort of that worldwide level?
I think the interesting part is that because of Cyclothem, to a certain extent, the Global Women's Cycling Day that we created, a lot of women actually reach out to us for support, and so we get to be a part of some pretty amazing stories. outside of Afghanistan, where Shannon Galpin's doing some pretty amazing work. She's building a women's team. If you don't know about Afghan Cycles, you should definitely check them out. She's doing a great job. And also Kimberly Coates, who works with Team Rwanda. And so we just do our best to tell their stories and provide whatever support we can, if it's connecting them with people that they need to connect with. Or, I think the biggest part for them a lot of times is just feeling that they're not there alone, that the reality is that a lot of the challenges that we're dealing with are the same all over the world,
right?
And encouraging more women to ride. So it's just a matter of kind of taking what we've learned and implementing it in different ways to fit different cultures to build those communities.
Well, you mentioned Cyclofemme a little bit earlier. How did it go this year? It's always Mother's Day, right?
It is.
How did it go?
It was just awesome. I'll tell you, I was in Fort Collins and the craziest thing happened. It snowed. So it was, personally, it was like this, this time where I kind of was a little bit disappointed because I'm riding in the snow and our ride wasn't as big. But, of course, Cyclofemme isn't about me. It's about this whole thing that's happening all over the world. And so as soon as the pictures started to stream in, it was just like this amazing feeling and amazing thing to be a part of. We had 303 rides in 25 countries. And the coolest thing about it was just that each ride was so much bigger. And we have a lot of communities now that have put on rides 3 years in a row. So they're just growing exponentially. Now they're getting sponsors. They're working with local businesses to provide them with, drinks and snacks and all kinds of fun stuff for their rides. And so it's really becoming, not just a singular ride, but a community event in a lot of places.
Yeah, and to remember when you very first started, on that small scale, and now to see it grow, it's really fascinating to see how exciting it's become. One of the things that you stress throughout your work is an idea that you call stories of people and events and places, and especially stories, of course, about women. So you have a new story to tell this week, and it's pretty exciting. Women Race Bikes, WRB. Tell us about your new story.
It's pretty amazing. We're launching into women's race coverage with this new platform called Women Race Bikes. Our goal is to, like you just said, tell these really amazing stories of women that are racing their bikes, mostly in the U.S., but really all over the world. We want to be able to follow women that start here and go other places to race, and connect them with the stories that are happening in, Rwanda, where the team is developing, and in Afghanistan. It's just a really cool thing. For me, I haven't ever been a really, really big part of the race scene. And I went to Torre de Gila this year down in New Mexico and rode in the team car a couple days and with UHC, and wow, it was one of the coolest experiences of my life. And just watching these women and their strategy and how hard they were working, and just like this enthusiasm and this grit that they had for this race. But then afterwards, Carmen Small and Allison Powers, after they've just sprinted it out to the finish, they're walking down the street to go have a glass of wine together.
Yeah,
so
sure.
It's just the coolest thing. It's completely different than what we've been told is going on in the Peloton. And women have a special story and we want to tell it.
Well, so it is a new platform. You're working with Tour Tracker?
Yes. The creator of Tour Tracker is working with us to help us develop something similar, but very specific to women race bikes. That'll be used for going to road races, because that's really what it was built for, to follow, the stage races and stuff like that. It's just a really fantastic tool. But we intend to have some pretty awesome things going on for mountain and BMX and track and everything else in between too. So that should be good.
So you launched a fundraiser on Indiegogo this week, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about the program on Indiegogo.
So the Indiegogo campaign is to raise funds to kind of give us our launch. There's a lot of things that we need to money for. We have to build an amazing website. We want to make it interactive and exciting and very dynamic. We also need funds to travel to races, to get the really good stories, take pictures, or to pay freelancers. And then, of course, you know, we have the app that we're developing, and, you know, it adds up. So that's what the Indiegogo is. But it's also a really good opportunity for us to let people know how important this is. So if people donate $15, they're saying, I believe in this. I want women's race coverage. We want women's racing to grow, and this is how we can do it. So it's funny because a friend of mine compared it to being naked in an airport with a hula hoop and a megaphone asking for loose change. And I'll tell you what, crowdfunding feels like that.
Let me tell you the visual that I just got on that.
Yeah.
It's pretty bizarre. Well, it is interesting, and I think women's racing has come a long way, but the part that was missing is the Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin part.
I completely agree with you, and even, you know, on our end, we're working with some women who are really great commentators and really should be in those sorts of positions, and so, you know, we're hoping to make that possible. I'm not sure how that's going to happen yet, but, you know, if you listen to some of the guys talk about the race, it's a little bit different. I mean, I'm not complaining at all, but we have some pretty amazing women with some really great voices, like Meredith Miller. You know, she's been in that pack. She's been in that peloton. She's raced cross. She's raced mountain bikes. She's raced road bikes. She's been there. And she, you know, she was telling me the other day, she's like, I know who those women are, not by their numbers, but because of the way they move on a bike. And that's, you know,
that's interesting, actually.
Isn't it?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. It's like if you follow golf, for example, and you see somebody swing, you go, oh, that's so-and-so's swing. You know, it's that kind of recognition of somebody's form, or in this case, form on a bike. That is interesting. So tell us again where people can actually go. It's the Indiegogo site, and you're calling it WRB, Women Race Bikes, right?
On Indiegogo, it's Women Race Bikes, so that should be an easy way to find it. The other thing that everybody can do is use their social media. Use the hashtag Women Race Bikes. You know, follow us on Twitter, follow us on Instagram, you know, Facebook, all that stuff. That's another way to use your voice to say this is really important.
Well, I wish you, as always, lots of luck. It's wonderful to catch up with you. We will be watching Women Race Bikes. The campaign is on Indiegogo. And good luck with it.
Thank you, Diane.
All right. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too.
Take care, Sarai.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Sarai Snyder joined me from Salt Lake City, Utah. Well, I think on that note, we're going to end the show.
Okay.
All right. Indiegogo, Women Race Bikes. It's going to be a really interesting year for women in the bicycle world, I think. And remember, the tour is still going on, that big race across the pond.
Yep.
And we hope you'll join us next week on The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for listening. Go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week. We'll